Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and look, we're not going to beat around the bush. We're going to get straight into it today. We are delighted to be joined on the line by Dr. Cliona Ní Chealaig, who is an infectious disease and internal medicine physician. Cliona, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. I'm honoured to be here with you.
Would you stop?
I am.
Listen, look, I suppose we want to jump straight into it.
Yeah.
Do you want to give, like, first of all, an infectious disease, but you're specializing with the socioeconomic impact of these things. So do you want to explain to listeners what, first of all, who you are and what that means in essence, and how we can relate that to COVID?
Of course. So I always had trouble keeping my colouring within the lines. So I trained in infectious diseases, worked a lot in St. James's, a lot with people who are living with HIV. And in James's, because of where it is, we would have had a lot of drug users that I would have looked after, people who are homeless, people who are socially excluded. And I just got absolutely fascinated by trying to understand what made it so difficult for them to come into clinic and take their antiretrovirals. Because nowadays, HIV medicine is easy. You take your tablets, off you go. You know, see it in 6 months. But we had this small number of mostly young men who didn't come into clinic regularly because of other stuff that was going on. And they used to get really sick. So that kind of started me really, I suppose, getting obsessed with this question of why are some people's lives different and what do we need to do to make them get the same kind of access to tablets and treatments that everybody else has? And then it was a long rabbit hole with Austin O'Carroll, who you probably know.
I
went to hear him talk once, and it was this total light bulb moment. So he was talking about how do you set up a clinic to make it easy for, you know, people who are socially marginalized to come to. And it was just this light bulb moment. I was like, oh, we can do things differently. Like, it was just really cool. So then I just kept, you know, I was really interested, and I went to work in London for 6 months, did some work with a pathway team there who work with homeless people. And I recognized that as much as we need special services for people who are older, because they can be complicated to look after and need special expertise, or people at end of life, like palliative care, in the same way people who are socially excluded have different needs, that somebody needs to kind of be in charge of in the hospital and go, these are my patients, you know, I want them, they're mine, give them to me. So that's what I do, and I absolutely love that. So I work with an amazing nurse called Anne-Marie Lawley and a social worker called Niamh O'Rourke. You should actually have both of them on as well. They're cool.
We will.
And we have the best job. We absolutely love it. Our patients are sound. It's always interesting. And we've made loads of changes. Like, it's very easy to work people in Merchants Quay, DePaul, Ireland, Anna Liffey, Dublin Simon, they're all really keen to just get their patients sorted out. So that's what we do.
Yeah.
So I was happily think about what's wrong in our society that's making people sick, and to advocate as much as we can to change that. So I was happily pottering along doing that. And then coronavirus hit. So because my background is in infectious diseases, I was like, okay, you, everybody who's got infectious diseases training, come over here. So now I'm working on a COVID ward. I'm doing research on coronavirus as well, because I also have a PhD in immunology.
Yeah.
See, I like doing lots of different things. And so we're looking at research about that. And it looks like, sorry, John, I'm on a podcast. It what's coming in from America and from the UK, surprisingly, people who are poor are more at risk of getting coronavirus, and when they get it, they get sicker. You know, so we really need to understand that and act on it, because otherwise it's going to hit, as everything always does, those who have the least get hit the most.
Yep. And that's it. We can say with certainty that people who are living more chaotic lives have a lower immune system than
absolutely. And it's really cool, right? So if how society thinks about it in general is, it's like, it's people, well, first of all, it's people's fault for being poor, you know, they're bad people and that's why they're poor. And then it's their fault that their health is, because they smoke and they take drugs and they drink and they don't exercise and they don't eat healthily. But that's not actually true. So if you look at what poverty does to people's health, about 2/3 of it is nothing to do with what choices, in inverted commas, those people are making. It's to do with the effect of feeling like you're bottom of the pile, of feeling ashamed of who you are. This is Aiden. And that's really bad for the immune system. Donald broke a plate. It doesn't matter, sweetheart. We'll pick it up. It doesn't matter. You liked that plate. It's okay. We'll pick it up later, sweetie. Don't worry. We'll get another plate.
Leaving that in.
Yeah, leave that in.
That's fine. So and if you look in like monkeys and mice where there isn't cigarettes and there isn't drugs, monkeys or mice that are the bottom of the social pile, it affects their immune systems really profoundly. And your immune system also controls your behavior. So I think it's really fascinating. One of the things that society can kind of give out to people for doing when they're having a rough time is not having to get up and go to college, get a job, get your stuff sorted. But if you look in animal models anyway, the ones that are at the bottom of the pile, they have this chronic inflammation going on, like an alarm system going off in their bodies. And that actually makes them kind of lose hope, even as an animal. And I think that sometimes that's part of what we're seeing in people as well, part of it. Okay. The spatula is downstairs. Sorry, there's a pancake emergency.
You're okay.
There's a very burnt pancake.
I can actually smell that.
It's burnt. Sorry.
It's really like, but the idea of that, you know, we've seen that, as you say, in the animal kingdom, where, you know, the inflammation, as you were saying, it can affect digestion, affect immune systems. But in terms of, obviously, we know Austin as well, and we've spoken with Tony Duffin and the guys in Animalify and the guys, the work that they all do. So very much on the same side here. But in terms of what we're seeing now, we're trying to talk to people about in terms of no going back, in terms of the supports that are there for people post COVID that we're trying to do now.
Absolutely. So Austin has done amazing work, and Tony and everybody, in cocooning all the homeless people. So basically they're now in decent, you know, single rooms, hopefully some of them with their own kitchens, with psychological support and proper addiction treatment. And do you know what? They're much better.
Mm. Yeah.
Like the consultants in A&E and James's were going, where are all the homeless people that we see all the time coming in with things wrong with them? They're just happy because they're being looked after. They're getting the care that maybe they didn't get when they were kids, or certainly that they need now. So absolutely, please, can we not go back?
Yeah. But how do you go back? How do you go back?
I don't think you can, but you never should have. I mean, having 12 adults who don't know each other in a dorm room is bananas.
Don't trick me.
Okay, if you're good, I'll get you a treat. This is my parenting style.
I give them all an iPad and the Netflix password.
Yeah. How do you think we've got through schools being off?
So I'll go back to that again.
And I don't know how societally, how do we, like, we should never have accepted it in the first place. And now we've shown how easy it is not to do things that way. How do we not go back? I don't know. And that's why I need people like you to help us do that. Anybody want some children?
I have enough, thank you. I have enough.
They're not very handy around the house, but they're kind of cute.
I'll just go in with this. I'll ask this. Already the discussion has started about how are we going to pay for that, to pay for this virus. And we is a very dangerous word in all of this, because the last time it was we, it was those at the bottom level of society that suffered most.
Oh, yeah.
So how do we go back to this narrative of we and not they who actually have more money than they could ever spend in any human's lifetime?
I don't know, because one of the fundamental flaws with the argument the first time round and the second time round when they make it is that it's actually a much more expensive way to run things. Mm. You know, if you have people living in really dreadful conditions, if you're treating people terribly, they get sick or they can't look after their kids, or they end up in prison, or they end up in hospital. And those things are way more expensive than providing decent housing, decent lives for people. So I think that's some of the argument. I don't know, like, it's amazing to see how quickly when coronavirus hits, you know, we're all on the same page and we're all in it together, and how we can do that. And I don't understand why we can't do that at other times. I don't know. Any ideas, suggestions, please give them to me.
You've summed it up brilliantly, because what we often say on this podcast is that the solutions are there, and they're often the most financially viable thing.
Absolutely.
You know,
like
if you're telling me, like, we spoke to Dan van der Heuvel from the Netherlands, the drug testing unit, and he spoke about the fact that there were people they're going into this front door accommodation, and you know, they're using their drugs, and they're still still part of society. Many of them are net contributors, if we want to use that awful economic term. But you give them dignity, and all of a sudden you're not chasing them. So you know that would be my concern. Just in terms of
I just want to say one more thing on that. So I think with my research hat on, I think obviously like all the research and stuff I read is health research, but the problem is how we think about a person. So we look at like what happens within a year or 2 years. Like, you know, we live for a long time and we're not just a single unit that tracks through time. We're part of a community and a family. And I think if we could get some economic analysis that looked at the impact of things like own front door or things like drug policy on, you know, what is the huge cost to society, for example, of our current drug policy? Stick them in prison, costs a fortune, they come out, they're homeless, they're in hospital, you know, somebody's looking after their kids, they're being paid. It's just a disaster, and the person comes out with no dignity and no life at the end of it. Yeah. Call to economists, change the way you measure things.
Can I ask you, you're dealing face-to-face with people who traditionally been faceless in society.
Yeah.
Are they happier now than they were a month ago? Are you finding...
I haven't seen as many of them face to face, but what I heard was there was one particular fella who, now he'd be on the tougher end of figuring out how to get him sorted, right? You know, he's got a lot of mental health problems. He's been living in a tent for 20 years. He's not the most easy to get on with type, which is a real issue for people in terms of their health. You shouldn't need to be likable and polite to get your health sorted. But, you know, it's a real barrier. If you use a lot of curse words or are a bit angry, people don't treat you the same way. Anyway, so this fellow had been breaking my heart for many, many years. And he's now at the place he's in. He told his drug treatment center, it's like MTV Cribs. And suddenly, like he's getting registered on DCC's homeless list where he hasn't been for 20 years. So we could never get him housing because he was never registered because he'd never fill out the forms. And suddenly there's this difference. So I think so. But actually, Anne-Marie, who's still doing the homeless work full-time, would know more than I do. But the stuff I'm hearing sounds really good.
That's great.
Clina, I know you're very tight for time, and we really appreciate you giving us the 50 minutes that you have. When this settles down, we will have to get you in the work you guys do, it is inspirational, and it's really appreciated, and I hope more people pick up on it. We're talking about no going back. Absolutely no way.
And that's a great name for a campaign. And count us all in. We will row in behind you, and you'll find even, you know, maybe some of these slightly Thatcherite consultants, nobody in particular in mind. Please edit this out. Also now will agree because they've seen the benefit.
Yeah, I genuinely do think so. There's no question that
Angie Wallace, who used to work for Focus Ireland and now works for DCC, and she is one of the biggest legends. Like, just she was telling me about the fella in MTV Cribs, and she said, we can never put them back. How are we going to take them out? We can't, and we really can't. No going back. #.
Brilliant. Clina, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Clina.
Thank you for all you do. Lovely to meet you.
You too.
I'd just like to make a pitch, folks. Look, we're trying very hard and we are losing patrons all the time.
Unfortunately. Martin, I don't want to interrupt you. We understand why people are...
We totally get this. We're not getting this. Look, if you have the few bob, if you've managed to hang on to the job and you're getting a few bob in, show us a few bob, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We really want to stay going. We're having interesting conversations with interesting people. And as time progresses, this is going to get more and more interesting about not going back.
Talk to y'all soon, folks. Thanks.